Now, a report released yesterday from Gizmodo alleged that curators for Facebook's trending section regularly filter out conservative news. The social media site responded by saying it's taking these allegations very seriously and affirmed its role as a platform for people and perspectives from across the political spectrum.
Benjamin Mullen joins us now to talk about the news and the role Facebook plays in how people consume their news. He's a managing editor at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, what do you think of this report from Gizmodo?
I don't know. I think it's super interesting because it sort of pulled the curtain back from this imperious institution that sort of determines how we get our news every day. And, you know, Facebook has been very circumspect in the past about which stories we see on our news feed and how, you know, what the algorithm is that determines how we see them. So I think it's a really interesting step back and an examination of, you know, how the sausage is made every day.
We'll dig into Facebook's role in providing news a little more in a bit. But if this report is correct, that Facebook is filtering out conservative news, or at least specific people at Facebook were doing this, and of course Facebook has denied this, how big a deal is that?
I think that, I mean, Facebook's trending section is largely, I don't think it sets the news agenda every day. You know, I think people still turn to, you know, public radio, the New York Times, CNN. I don't think Facebook's trending stories are the tastemakers for what we talk about every day. At the same time, I do think it's an indicator that Facebook, you know, I think it's an indicator that Facebook is an institution that has human biases, and because it's such a enormous driver of traffic to news websites, you know, because so many news organizations depend on Facebook to basically be financially sustainable. I think it is an interesting indicator that, you know, this institution that's really important to the sustainability of newsrooms does have human biases. So to that extent, I think it is important, but I don't think it's going to, be an ultimate tastemaker for, you know, the news writ large.
A lot of people find this story surprising because the idea was that this trending news section was algorithm-based and it was user-generated. It searched what people were posting, determined what people were most interested in, and shared it there as a trending thing. The idea here appears to be that there's a human hand on the tiller, and not just necessarily weeding out particular political biases, but another allegation was that they were injecting stories into the trending, say, oh, there was a major terrorist attack, it's not showing up on trending, we're going to put that in there. So what do you think of this idea of algorithm-based trending news versus having a human input there?
You know, I think it's interesting. My preference would be whether your news is going to be determined by an algorithm or a person, that whatever it is, you make it clear to the person, to the audience, what's actually going on. And I think part of the reason why you saw such a huge outcry here was because this was, on Facebook's part, such an opaque method for determining who saw what. I think if folks had known all along that these were people, you know, in New York or in Silicon Valley determining what we saw, I don't think you'd see this much of an outcry. But I think the fact that either we all assumed it was algorithmically driven or, I think the fact that we didn't know how it was being determined, I think that's why you're seeing such an outcry. I think people are now reacting to having the wool pulled over their eyes. And I think that's part of why you're seeing such a strained reaction.
Once upon a time, Facebook was a social media platform. We shared our kid pictures and cat pictures and what we ate for a meal. Now it's blurred slowly and maybe intentionally into a media enterprise. But has it taken journalistic enterprise to make sure that it's doing it right?
I don't think that it has. I mean, I think Facebook considers itself, and rightly so, a distributor of the news and not, you know, a producer of the news. But Facebook has a huge, huge responsibility as the primary mediator of the news that we see and the information that we consume in my opinion, to adopt some of the standards and practices that you see from news organizations. So, for example, does Facebook need a reader representative to sort of make clear how we're seeing what we're seeing? Does it need to be more clear about what factors determine what we see in its newsfeed algorithm? I think as Facebook has evolved as a mediator for the news that we consume, I don't think it's lived up to its responsibility to, you know, be a transparent organization that helps us either, you know, curtail our news diet or tailor it or give us the tools that we need to empower ourselves to be more savvy consumers of media.
We're talking to Benjamin Mullen from the Poynter Institute now about a new report alleging that Facebook filters out conservative news from its trending news section.
And we're taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. Do you consider Facebook to be a legitimate news source? Where do you get your news? And what do you think of the idea about Facebook as becoming a major news source? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our discussion now with Benjamin Mullen from the Poynter Institute about a new report alleging that Facebook filters out conservative news from its trending newsfeed.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your take on this new report about Facebook maybe filtering out conservative news? Facebook does deny that they do this. Where do you get your news? Do you get a lot of it from social media, from your friends, from that newsfeed? Call 800-642-1234. Or post, yes, on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Bill on the line in Mauston. Bill, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think, Bill?
When I am scrolling through my news feed, the news that I see is all posted by people that are my friends on Facebook. I've never seen anything from Facebook itself. So are they filtering out the posts that people put up? Is that what they're saying?
Bill, thanks a lot for that call and that question. And I had to go back and look at my own Facebook page, Benjamin, because I'm not somebody who looks at that news feed. I think all of us have, if we have Facebook, off to the upper right, there's a news feed. There are trending news stories under the word trending. I got to say, Ben, this was not on my radar. Clearly wasn't on Bill's either.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how consequential this really is. I don't know how much referral traffic this trending, this trending box actually drives to people. I think by and large, most of the stuff people see is recommended by their friends through that Facebook news feed. But again, I think Facebook's news feed is also, to a degree, just as opaque in terms of how it's determined as that trending news box is. So I think his point's very well taken, but at the same time, you have to wonder, you know, is it time for Facebook to be a little bit more transparent for both of those things?
And that's a point you seem to come back to, Ben, the idea of transparency. It's a value for a lot of news organizations. You think it's time for social media sites, especially Facebook, to try to be more transparent in their news sharing?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely do think so. I mean, you know, you see things like Twitter, which is something that's determined algorithmically also. You see Facebook, which is something that's determined algorithmically. I think something like Apple News, which everybody, you know, millions of people have it on their cell phone, that's something that I don't think it's determined by an algorithm, a computer formula, but you know, Google News, which is one of the primary drivers of traffic to news organizations and one of the primary ways that we determine how we see what we see. That's another thing that's mediated by sort of a mysterious algorithm that we don't have the secret sauce on. Algorithms do need a certain amount of opacity in order to make it sure that you can't game them, right? So we don't want somebody figuring out exactly how Facebook determines how we see what we see, or else they could, you know, tweak things to make sure that, you know, you could fool the algorithm to make sure that, you know, we only saw the news stories that you wanted to see. So it's a balance. You have to have enough opacity so that people can't game the system, but you also want it to be transparent enough so that people understand why they're seeing what they're seeing. But I do think these various organizations, Google, Facebook, Twitter, could be more transparent about, you know, why we're looking at the stories that we are.
Bring on another caller now. David is on the line in Alaska. David, hi.
Hi there. Just wondering, why does Facebook need to be transparent about this? I mean, I understand that it's an open site, but if you go to Fox News or you go to CNN, you know the news that you're getting. I mean, is that because Facebook has a news feed that you have to expect that it's unbiased and you're not going to get a slant to the left or the right, but they need to, you know, come out and disclose this?
David, thanks. We also heard from Pradeep in Milwaukee, who said, doesn't a private organization like Facebook have the right to filter the news on their site? So it's their website, they get to do what they want, Ben.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think the difference between Facebook and, say, you know, Fox News or CNN is that people implicitly, when they tune into CNN, they understand how the sausage gets made, right? I think CNN, for example, it, you know, like we all saw Mary Tyler Moore. We all saw, you know, pick, you know, the pop culture show that involves a intrepid reporter trying to break the news. Like, we all get how that process works. And I think when we come to those news organizations, when we read a newspaper, when we watch CNN, we come to that experience with a certain understanding of how we got where we got. But I think you don't have that same expectation when it comes to Facebook. Are they within their rights as a company legally, you know, to make the decisions that they want to? Yes, although today somebody from either the Congress, the House of Representatives, or the Senate sent a letter to Facebook saying, I'm concerned that you're doing this. So it's possible that this kind of thing could wind up in court. But I think beyond the legal concerns, if you were asking me, I would say that there are ethical concerns because, you know, people don't have the same expectation and understanding of how the sausage gets made when they come to Facebook and Twitter and Google as they do when they come to CNN. We understand that there are people making those decisions and they're in front of the camera. In this case, I don't think it's as clear.
David, thanks for that call. Yeah, we had just heard about that Senate letter before we came on the show. I imagine we're going to be talking about Facebook's impact on the media for a long time. Benjamin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
We've been talking to Benjamin Mullen. He's with the Poynter Institute about a new report alleging Facebook filters out conservative news from its trending section. We'll be watching that news and talking more about Facebook and the media in the future.
Coming up after the news, it appears that Prince died without a will, which may have big consequences for his musical legacy. We find out why our guest says it's important to have a will, even if you're not a rock star.
And remember, you can support conversations like these with your pledge to WPR right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll learn about why more women are becoming farmers in Wisconsin.
First, a lot of people were shocked to hear that the music legend Prince died without a will. Well, it might be surprising that someone like him, who had significant assets and a musical legacy to protect, would not have done estate planning. He is definitely not alone. Less than half of Americans have actually written a will.
And while the process may seem intimidating, our next guest says that writing a will is an important and valuable step to take. Attorney Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi is the founder of the Gustafson-Gervasi Law Office in Madison, where she practices estate law. She's the author of the book Middle Class Philanthropist, How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy. Melinda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, were you surprised when you heard that Prince, you know, a performer of this magnitude, had died without a will?
I was, especially when I saw the article that was talking about how he'd been surrounded by business attorneys and business advisors and was very shocked that no one had convinced him about the importance of doing a will.
Well, I mean, I suppose he, at least publicly, did not have any children. I imagine a lot of people think, well, I only have one child, or it's very simple. Is this common that people choose not to have a will or decide they maybe don't need one?
I think it's quite common. And studies I have read say about 34% of Americans have a will, but yet 80% of us believe that having a will is very important. And in the article that I read, it talked about the fact that they don't have one because they really don't know where to start financially. I think in Prince's case, it was a little bit more unique. unique given his high net worth. In his case, without the proper planning, he was going to his estate will be subject to some very hefty federal estate taxes. Most Americans aren't going to face those because you need a net worth that exceeds $5 million. But it can be a big hit when it does happen.
So for people who, as you say, don't know how to start, what is the answer to that? How do you start something that sounds daunting at the offset?
I would say first, educate yourself a bit. There's lots of resources out there. You can read things on NOLO.com or go to your library and look for estate planning terms. You can go to a seminar that's in your community and start gathering some information. This is a state-specific matter, so I always say in the seminars that I do, federal law is something like immigration. That's the same whether you're in Maine or California. But estate planning laws are written at the state level, and they will vary from state to state. So I emphasize looking for Wisconsin-specific documents when you can. The UW Extension Financial Education Center has a wonderful pamphlet that they have put together, and I think it costs $6. And it's the basics of estate planning. It's very straightforward in the way it's written. There's lots of diagrams to help digest more complex issues, and I think that would be a great place to start. I also say that estate planning is really three things. It's planning for illness, death, and taxes. And one of the things that I've seen skipped over in a lot of the discussion is it's important to have a will, but oftentimes much more important to have a power of attorney. There's one for healthcare, there's one for finance, because the question becomes, if you are alive but you're too sick to make your healthcare or financial decisions, who will make those? And Wisconsin law has no automatic assumption that it would be your spouse or your adult child. And sometimes what used to kill us doesn't, and we can have a very prolonged illness and a lack of a path on who's going to make those decisions. So first it's planning for illness. Then it would be the question of doing a will. The other thing that I think that's come up with this discussion about prints, I think, is the lack of discussion of what we call direct transfers or non-probate property. We don't know if he had investment accounts, insurance policies, or other things that had some sort of label on them that left them directly to an heir or to a specific sibling or to an employee, perhaps. Transfer will happen no matter what, if he'd had a will, the will had said, or in this case, state statute.
Do you have to have a lawyer involved? Because these days there's so much available online. I know there are wills online that you could fill out, and it might not be signed and sealed by a lawyer, but there would be your wishes in writing. Is that sufficient?
You do not need a lawyer to help you do the process. You can certainly work through things on your own. A lawyer should make it a lot easier for you to work through the process. And I would encourage people, if they don't have the means to work with a lawyer or they just don't want to have the experience of working with a lawyer, to actually look to, there's a free, or not free, but a very low cost, I think it's $10, Wisconsin fill-in-the-blank will that I believe is available through the Wisconsin State Law Library. Fortunately, the last time I checked, it's not online. You have to send them payment. But it's literally a fill-in-the-blank document that is written specifically for Wisconsin residents. The things that I see are problematic with sort of the mass-marketed nationwide documents are they're not specific to your state, and terms can vary. So, for example, we call it personal representative here. In other states, they call it executor. So you can get very confused on the terms. And also, they don't guarantee that it'll meet with the requirements of your state, such as the number of witnesses that are required.
So for someone who might be worried about sort of the emotional issues that are entailed, I mean, it is a challenging thing to confront our own death. What do you suggest when you see clients or want to encourage people to overcome that and try to get this document in place?
I would say focus on the word control. These decisions are going to be made, and you're the best person to make them. And if you don't take control of the situation, someone else will. And if you care about the loved ones you're leaving behind, getting yourself organized in this area will save them a tremendous amount of money, time, and emotion. It's not easy, and it's not going to be easy, so know that going into it. And that's why I say I have a three-ring binder with all of my documents in it. And instead of having the subject dividers that say English, math, or science, it says powers of attorney, will, beneficiary forms, people to contact. Create a binder. And then work on filling that in. Don't try to do it all at one time, but work on it. And then once you've done it, there are many people who think, oh, I did an estate plan in the 80s. You need to make sure that it's updated and reflects your current situation.
So what are some times when we might want to think about updating a will if we have one in place already? Mm-hmm.
I always kind of joke about myself. So, for example, in 2006, I went from having a long name to a very long name when I got married. In 2008, my son was born. In 2009, my father died. In 2010, my daughter was born. And in 2014, my mother died. Those were all times that my parents should have been looking at their documents because their daughter's name changed. I had gotten married. I'd had a child. My documents should have been changed. My in-laws now had grandchildren. My mother became a widow. Those are all life events. So when we have a marriage, a birth, a death, a divorce are times when you should look at them. Sometimes people think, oh, every set number of years I should look at it. And unfortunately, I think it's more dependent on life situations. And you could have three very traumatic things happen or three wonderful things happen in a short period of time and then go 10 years with not many changes.
Now, if someone is just beginning this process, what are some of the ways that they might start thinking through? For instance, one tricky one would be how to divide their assets if they've got, for instance, more than one child.
I always say to think about where it would do the most good. I also think you should learn about what the state statutes say. We hear a lot of discussion, they died without a will. Well, technically, that's not correct. Everyone has a will. It's written in the state statutes. The question is, do you agree with the distribution plan that the legislature has created for you? So that's where you might want to sit down and figure out what that says and then react to it. Do I agree with this? The book that I referenced by UW Extension in the back has a very nice pictorial graph of what that distribution would be. And you could look at that and say, do I agree on that? I think after that is always asking yourself, where would this do the most good? Many times my clients will come in and it's obvious. I want to leave everything to my spouse. And if my spouse is gone, equally to our children. Where they stumble is when I ask, well, what happens if something happens to your husband or in your children? And then they're, you know, they need to think about that. And that's where I think thinking about where it would do the most good can be very useful. Because in a way, it allows you to maybe give back to an organization or institution that has supported you during your lifetime and can make this process a little bit easier, knowing that you could do something good.
We're speaking right now with attorney Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi talking about why it's important to leave a will. Prince did not have one, and a surprising number of people may choose not to update it or get specific with it, as we're learning about, and we're learning about how to do that today. And Melinda, you also focus on philanthropy. You've got a book, in fact, called Middle Class Philanthropist, How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy. Is being able to give to the organizations that maybe are near and dear to your heart part of what you think leaving a will is all about?
I think it can be. As I just said, many times people know where they'd want it to go to a spouse if they were to pass or to their children. Sometimes, unfortunately, we outlive them. And then thinking about where we give our time to the organizations we really care about, they'll feel our absence when we're gone. Perhaps you can do something monetarily. I also think that people think you need to be Bill Gates in order to be a philanthropist, and you don't. You could strategically leave $2,000 to a specific nonprofit, and if you're very specific with those intentions, it could have a huge impact on that small nonprofit. There are four different people or estates that are profiled in my book who left relatively modest gifts but have kind of snowballed, spurred other people to give, and in one case, it was about 3 years of revenue for the one nonprofit and allowed them to focus on the true mission of their organization and not just trying to fundraise all the time.
And getting back to the concluding aspects of this, let's say you spend some time with your attorney, you've consulted, you know how you want to divide things. What happens next? How does that will sort of get stored and how do you access it later on?
Well, in this industry, paper still matters. And so in my office, when my clients are done, they leave with their original signed documents. I follow the recommendation of the state bar that lawyers not keep them. That way, the client has, I think, more customer-friendly or consumer-friendly way of when they want to update. They can choose to go back to that lawyer, or they can go to a new lawyer who maybe fits their needs. In terms of storing a document, I don't think it's best to keep it in a safe deposit box because oftentimes the document that's in the box is the one that says who can get into the box. And so you have a little bit of a chicken and egg problem. I advise clients on a fireproof box in the home. is often a nice way to do that. And I did have a firefighter point out that it should be a waterproof box as well, or put plastic on it. I personally have taken it a step further, and I have filed my document with the Dane County Courthouse. I live in Dane County, so I have filed it with the Dane County Probate Court for safekeeping. And the local county here charges, I believe it's $10 to hold a will. I feel that their safekeeping is a little bit more sound than what I would have in my own home.
And so going forward, we've had this discussion about why it matters. What would you say in closing to encourage anyone to take this step and do this no matter how young or old they may be?
Well, none of us are going to escape death. It's going to happen. The more organized you can be in this area, the easier it will be on those you've left behind. It is a monumental job to have to pick this up. And when people are dealing with their grief and their sadness and the emotions, the last thing they need is a fiscal mess. So I always say, aim for that binder. Try to fill it out as best you can. Everyone's will vary a little bit, but it's really a final gift of being organized and also taking that control over what you think should happen and not leaving it up to others to decide.
Melinda, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
That was Madison estate lawyer Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi. She's the author of the book Middle Class Philanthropist: How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy.